Assalamu alaikum. Good afternoon. My name is Salman Sheikh. I'm the director of the Brookings Doha Center. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce this particular event and the esteemed panelists I have to my left. Let me first also welcome distinguished ambassadors and friends of the Brookings Doha Center who are already here, as well as the participants of the just-finished Brookings U.S. Islamic World Forum. You're most welcome being here as well. It's a great event we have, I'm sure you'll agree. The title, as you know, to discuss what does a U.S.-Iran rapprochement mean for the Middle East? And in this regard, I couldn't think of a better group of people who are to my left. First of all, Professor Abbas Malki, he's Associate Professor of Energy Policy in the Department of Energy Engineering at Sharif University of Technology in Tehran. He's Senior Associate as well at Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Professor Malki is Deputy for International Research at the Center for Strategic Studies at the Expediency Council as well. He has a focus particularly on publications on energy policy, energy security, public policy, and Iran's foreign policy. He was Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran from 1980 to 1997, and one of the members of the negotiating team that helped end the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted a devastating from 1987 to 1992. It's real pleasure to have you here, Professor Malki. I know this is the second time you are joining us. Thank you for coming from Tehran. Next, my great friend, colleague, Suzanne Maloney, Senior Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, where her research focuses on energy and economic reform and U.S. policy towards the Middle East. More recently, she was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff, covering Iran, Iraq, the Gulf states, and the broader Middle East issues. Prior to joining government, she was in the private sector, working as a Middle East advisor at ExxonMobil Corporation, and she's also recipient of lots of international awards and fellowships, the Council on Foreign Relations, and previously served at Brookings as an Olin Fellow and a Brookings Research Fellow. Suzanne, it's great to have you here. Thank you for staying by and not catching the plane straight away to Washington. Thank you. And certainly not least, we have Dr. Abdullah Baboud, who's the Director of the Gulf Studies Center at Qatar University. He has a particular focus on the areas of regionalism and globalization, and his interests specifically focus on the Gulf states' economic, political, security, and social development, as well as their external relations. He's, of course, participated in numerous international conferences, workshops, and seminars, and has several publications to his credit. He's a member of the academic and research institutions, as well as business organizations. Abdullah has held several positions in business and academia, and his last post before joining Qatar University was as the director of the Gulf Research Center at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Abdullah, you're a friend of the center. It's great to have you on a Brookings platform. Thank you. Now, the subject at hand, what does the U.S.-Iran rapprochement mean for the Middle East? Of course, we wouldn't be complete if we didn't first start discussing, are we going to be able to get there? So, Professor Malki, I'd like to turn to you first. Is there going to be a deal? Is there going to be a deal by July the 20th, as things stand, in your view?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much for your invitation. I think this is the 50-50 in probability to reach to the July, after 20th of July. But I am optimistic to be done this case after maybe a second, 6 months later, which is accepted for both sides, I think, I mean Iran and P5+1, from 20th of July for 6 months, again discussions, and as both sides, especially yesterday after a talk between Iran and United States representatives, both sides said it is possible to talk because there are some divergent among the targets, goals, and the way which we must reach to the agreement in both sides. There are some different views. Therefore, I am optimistic for the next 6 months also, and then it is possible to reach to agreement.
Optimistic for the next 6 months, so we may need a little bit more time.
I'm optimistic for reaching to an agreement.
Thank you. Suzanne, what do you think? How close are we to a deal?
Thank you so much, Salman, and thank you to the Brookings Doha Center for the privilege of being on a panel with such distinguished experts from both Qatar and Iran. I'm very pleased to participate in this conversation. I would like to start off the discussion actually by finding one small area of U.S.-Iranian agreement, which is I share Dr. Maliki's view that we are in a difficult position to get to a deal prior to the July 20th deadline for the interim agreement that was signed last November. It's not impossible, but I think that you can see by the fact that the A-team of American diplomacy, Deputy Secretary of State William Burns and some of his colleagues from the Office of the Vice President and elsewhere in the U.S. government, who were part of a secret negotiating team that was reaching out to Iran many months before we saw the public diplomacy that led to the deal last fall. They were redeployed this week in a direct and this time public bilateral conversation with their Iranian counterparts. And I think that's a recognition of just how far the distance remains with only 39 days to go before the expiration of that interim agreement. But I, perhaps more so than many of my colleagues who have a finer grasp of many of the technical details of the nuclear issue itself, remain optimistic that in fact we will eventually see a comprehensive, permanent nuclear agreement between Iran and the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. I'm optimistic for a variety of reasons, but mostly because of what has happened within Iran, what we've seen from the administration of Hassan Rouhani since his election just about 1 year ago this week.
Great. Suzanne, I'll keep you on for a second. Who in the United States wants or needs a deal the most?
Partisan issue, of course, and it is clear that President Obama has been invested in diplomacy toward Iran really since he campaigned for office, even in his primary campaign against his future Secretary of State, then rival Hillary Clinton, and perhaps a future presidential candidate. He was very outward-leaning on the need for dialogue with adversaries, and I think he's remained committed to that view. We see it in this, you know, sort of private diplomacy and the efforts to find a way to talk to Iran, even when the domestic politics of Iran seemed least conducive to any forward progress. Needs a deal, not so much for his legacy, although it obviously would be one positive legacy in a foreign policy track record that is rather checkered at the moment. He needs a deal because he doesn't need a war, because he doesn't need a protracted crisis and the potential fiscal implications of a conflict in this region. But he doesn't need a deal so badly that he's likely to accept any deal.
Professor Maliki, are the Iranians united in pursuing this deal?
Yes and no. Yes, because this is the case of national interests of Iranians. Iranians, most of them or all of them, they have suffered from the of the lack of development during these years, especially in the previous government and administration. Most of them, they received many, many limitations. For example, one limit which is very simple maybe in the first step is that if you want to go to Europe, it is about 4 to 5 hours by flight. But now it is more than 10 hours because every Iranian airplane must go to, when it is flying to London or Paris and others, they, in return, they must go to one of the Eastern Europe countries to fuel, to do fueling and then return to Tehran. It is very hard for Iranians, which they are very, very active in relations with other countries. Most of them, they want to go to other countries. Iran is a country with 78 million populations. Most of them, they are in middle class or rich part of the society. Most of them, they want to have shrines, pilgrimage, and other trips. Therefore, this is one case that I can say that they are happy to do that, to remove sanctions. The other issues also are very important for Iranians. Iranians, they are proud. Iran, the regional role of Iran has been dismissed during these years. Now they are willing to have again the role which Iran has had historically from 5,000 years ago in this region until now. Therefore, all of Iranians, they are ready to do that. Yes, but some Iranians, they have ideologically or economically, they received something during the 8 years ago, some of them, but they are very few that they think it's better to not reach to an agreement. And some of them, as Susan said, they believe bad deal is worse than not deal. Therefore, they have some reservations. And Iran is a pluralistic society. They are talking, they have many interviews in radio, television, and media. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Abdullah, you, of course, are originally an expert from Oman, and of course the Sultanate of Oman has played a very important role. But I want to ask you more broadly about the regional angle and the Gulf in particular. Where does the Gulf stand as we move to the sort of the sharp point of whether we achieve a deal or not?
Thank you very much. And also, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Brookings for inviting me, but also for jointly organizing this event, which we are very proud to have the Gulf Studies Center, Qatar University, alongside with Brookings organizing this event. Thank you for that. The question is where the Gulf stands regarding the deal. It's, of course, difficult to answer it in a few sentences, but as you know, there is no common Gulf policies as such. We are talking about 6 Gulf states that are members of the GCC, but with almost 6 different foreign policies. So it is difficult to explain that there is a common policy towards Iran. Now, of course, Oman brokered and helped the deal and helped the secret negotiations and talks between Iran and the United States, and also for, you know, good obvious reasons. And Oman diplomacy is known for this, avoiding any conflicts in the region, etc. Qatar has always had a good relationship with Iran, so there was no issue with that. The other Gulf states, mainly Saudi Arabia, which is the heavyweight in the within the GCC, they were, of course, shocked initially with the rapprochement, with the negotiations, because the deal or the negotiations came at a time when the whole region is in turmoil, when there is a talk about the US leaving and departing from the region, rightly or wrongly, but that was their perception, at least. There was the issue about, you know, the Asian pivot. America and U.S. forces are redeploying or leaving Afghanistan, leaving Iraq. And of course, there was kind of fear in the region that the U.S. is leaving the area open without much security. But also, the Arab Spring and the whole changes that were happening in the geopolitics of the region had scared the Gulf states when they saw that the Americans are not just leaving the region in their own perception, which I think they were not, but that's how it was perceived. But also, it was they're not only leaving the region, but also talking to the Iranians, and therefore the idea of the grand bargain may have raised its ugly head again. And here we're going to have a grand bargain at the expense of the Gulf states, especially that the Gulf states themselves did not see that they were consulted on this, or they were not brought into the negotiation tables. And of course, there are many issues that the Gulf states here have with Iran, and they would have liked to have a say on those issues, and maybe that's something we can come to later if you want to, or if you press me. Do it now.
Great. I just want to press you a little bit more on those who have shown some intrepidation, shock, or fear of a nuclear deal in the region. How, you said, a fear particularly of a grand bargain which would move things. How can are those fears being alleviated as we now move into this current phase of talks towards a deal?
Well, two issues. One, why was there a fear? Because the Gulf states have always had an antagonist relationship with Iran, with some episodes where there was some dialogue with Iran during Khatami's time. But through the recent history, even during the Shah of Iran, the relationship hasn't been at its best, even during the dual, during the American policy of having Iran and Saudi Arabia as the two pillars in the region. And of course, the relationship has over time deteriorated. There is a lot of misperception on both sides. And there are a number of issues, whether they are the islands in the Gulf, that UAE islands that both sides claim right to it, that Iran does not want to negotiate. There is, of course, the issue of the most important issue, which is the nuclear issue that the Gulf states are extremely fearful of, Iran developing a nuclear capability. But also Iran's policies in the region, whether it's Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain, and what they see as Iran meddling in the Gulf states politics or the Arab politics. So that's the perception from their side. And of course, they were worried that Iran has been, instead of continuing with the sanction and putting Iran down and forcing it to negotiate on these issues, that Iran has actually been awarded for being a pariah state. Here is the United States, and here is the P5 plus one are awarding it a seat on the table, talking to it. And not only that, the Gulf states are excluded. So that's their perception. And of course, they have, to a certain extent, some right in voicing it. But you can see that the reality has kicked in. Immediately after the announcement, we saw that the GCC as a group welcomed the rapprochement and the GCC summit meeting. And immediately the foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates flew into Iran, to Tehran, to talk to the Iranians. Following that, we recently saw a visit by the Emir of Kuwait, which again signifies that the GCC states have changed their mind. But again, not only Kuwait, but Saudi Arabia in particular, has sent signs, an invitation to the Prime Minister, to the Foreign Minister, Sharif, to visit Saudi Arabia, to visit Riyadh. And you can see that the pendulum has shifted. Instead of trying to be against it, they are now trying to see that there are signs that perhaps we can talk to the Iranians. And instead of blaming Oman for instigating this, now people have realized that Oman has actually played a very important role, avoiding more conflict in the region, because there are benefits that both sides of the Gulf can have by having a constructive dialogue and by overcoming their differences through that dialogue.
Thank you. Okay, let's go a little bit forward now, and let's hope that there is a deal which is struck, which is acceptable to all. We still have the issue that you, Abdullah, mentioned in terms of not just a nuclear issue, but other issues that regional states may have with Iran's policies. Let me ask you with regards to Syria. What does Syria look like after U.S.-Iranian rapprochement?
I think Iran and Levant has had relations, close relations in the history. Many Shiites, theologians, which they have been in Iran from 600 years ago, from 400 years ago, from Safavid Empire until now. They are from Jabal and the Lebanese region, Syrian rivers. And there are many holy shrines in Syria, which Iranians, they love to go to Syria. Regarding the geopolitics, even before revolution, Iranian government had good relations with socialist, fascist government in Syria. After revolution, it was the new arena for more cooperation, especially after the Saddam Hussein initiative to invade parts of Iran. Hafez Assad, the then president of Syria, did support Iran, and he stopped any flow of crude oil from Kirkuk-Banias pipeline, which was 1 million barrels per day, very crucial for Iraqi government. From that time, Iran and Syria, they did more cooperation until now. The case of Syria, as Iran said many times, it is inside of Syria we must look at a compromise, a dialogue, a solution. It is not advisable to other part of the world if one government has some negative behavior to the people. It is permitted to others, like countries like Turkey, Qatar, or Saudi Arabia, to intervene to that country. Anyhow, I think Iran will have good relations with Syria, and in future, I think, yes, it is true that Syria needs a lot of reforms in government, in social institutions, but I think the territorial integrity of Syria also is very important for Iran. And as I know, as I understand, the American side wants to talk about Syrian issue also, but now Iranian leadership believes it is better to concentrate only and only on nuclear issue.
Just a little bit more on Syria with you, Professor Malki. There would be some who would say that it's good, the stance that you just said, that there should be dialogue among Syrians, but that it is in fact the Assad regime which is not allowing that dialogue to take place or to flourish. And in this environment, how is it looking forward one can generate that kind of space?
Yes, I think Iran has a pivotal role in this issue that you mentioned. Yes, it is natural that the government of Syria doesn't permit those Salafis or extremists which has been accommodated by foreign countries to sit in table and talk. But I think Iran should mediate this case also, as Iran has good relations with the Syrian government, and also Iran has access to opposition. I'd say again, Iran has access to them. It is not, it doesn't mean that Iran believes that they are in right position. No, but has access to them. Last week it was a meeting in Tehran, 32 countries, which the name was Friends of Syrian State, they gathered. I think Iran can easily do the same between government of Syria and oppositions, but it is related to the domestic issues in Syria also.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you the same, but a little bit broader on terms, Suzanne, in terms of the regional issues, both with regards to Syria and Iraq and the other sort of list of complaints which we may well hear. What does a US-Iranian rapprochement mean for that basket of issues and the gulf there is in terms of trying to resolve those issues?
I'll be a little bit difficult here. I don't think we are seeing rapprochement, at least not within the foreseeable future. I'm not even sure that we're seeing détente, although I think that that's possible and it ought to be the objective that both Tehran and Washington strive for. I think what we may have is an arms control agreement, and hopefully it is a robust one that satisfies all of the concerns of the international community, including the concerns of Iran's closest neighbors. In the context of successful talks toward a really important arms control agreement on the nuclear issue, I think that there is room for greater dialogue and cooperation between Iran, the region, as well as Iran and many other world powers, including Washington, on the issues of greatest concern for the region. I think, in fact, it is incumbent upon all sides to try to facilitate that kind of a dialogue. And what we heard over the course of the past few days at the U.S. Islamic World Forum that was held here is that Syrians, at least some elements of the Syrian opposition, in fact, are quite open to incorporating Iran into a regional dialogue about the future of Syria and ways in which the conflict can be resolved. I'll be blunt, I see Iran as a combatant in Syria, and therefore there can be no durable peace, there can be no durable, stable outcome to this horrific crisis in Syria unless Iran is somehow bought into that process. And it won't be bought into the process unless it has a seat at the table, and I think that is the message that we've been seeing very clearly, hearing very clearly from Foreign Minister Zarif, both in his response to Secretary Kerry when this issue was raised at Munich last fall, as well as in his unavailability to attend the upcoming meeting of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the first real overture from the Saudis to the Iranians since the election last June. I think it's quite clear that the Iranians want to be part of a dialogue, but they're not prepared to give a lot, at least not right away. And I think that what we're seeing take place in Mosul and what's been taking place across Iraq and Syria over the course of recent months is only going to reinforce Tehran's commitment to preserving its access, its influence, and its dominance in Syria. This is precisely the outcome that they're afraid of, and it's only going to reinforce not just the position, but the role of those who make the decisions in Tehran, which we know extends well beyond President Rouhani to members of the Revolutionary Guard, who in fact have a very different worldview.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, and thanks for being difficult. We accept maybe there needs to be a regional dialogue. Can it be the United States, or what other body or entity can actually lead such a regional dialogue at this point in time?
I wish I had a good answer to that. I don't think that there is a natural convener of such a dialogue. Obviously, we have an absence of a UN envoy on this issue right now. Whether or not someone who comes into that position might be capable of drawing the relevant parties to the table, I don't think it's a role for Washington. I don't think that it's a role Washington can play. And I think ultimately it comes down to political will on the part of both Tehran and Riyadh. And that political will has been intermittent, and it has not coincided in the past. But I'd also say that, you know, over the course of particularly the past 25 years, since the end of the war between Iran and Iraq, since the death of Ayatollah Khomeini, both Iran and Saudi Arabia have endeavored to manage their tensions somewhat constructively. It took quite a while after the war to see a full reestablishment of diplomatic relations. But there is a sort of orientation among Iran's foreign policy establishment, and I think within the Saudi foreign policy establishment as well, that they don't want to see this spin out of control. And obviously what we're seeing, you know, with the horrific death toll in Syria and now the spread of that conflict and of those extremist groups into Iraq is the very something very close to a situation spinning out of control. And so I think that we're likely to see a real drive on the part of both Riyadh and Tehran to find a venue, to find a mechanism for direct and sustained conflict on Syria. Or, I'm sorry, conversation on Syria.
Thank you. Abdullah, on that question, in terms of how do we get a regional process and a regional discussion going to take up some of those issues. Do you think it can be Iran and Saudi Arabia, or could it be other, are there other Arab organizations or even Islamic ones that could take up this challenge?
I think to have any kind of understanding between Iran and the Arab world, you need to have Saudi Arabia as part of that. And Saudi Arabia and Iran have been, while they were at loggerheads with each other, we have seen hundreds of thousands of people being killed in Syria and Iraq and affected in Yemen as well. And it's basically a war that is being fought through proxies. And they've got to stop this proxies war, because it does not benefit anybody. And at the end of the day, neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia are going to benefit from this. How does it happen? I think I agree with Susan that what we are seeing here is going to be an arms control deal. But that in itself can give some confidence to the Gulf state that they can start talking to Iran on other issues, because the deal with the P5 plus one is only concentrating on the nuclear issue. I think we are talking about a region where foreign policy making is not generally through institutions. It's foreign policy making is mainly due to one or two people making it, and it's through the perception of those one or two people. So if you have a goodwill of the king, and of Ayatollah and Iran, the supreme leader, then you can get things going, and that is where this differs from other countries. So on one hand, you need the goodwill from both sides, but also other countries and other actors in the region can help. Oman facilitated the deal, but it needs someone else to also move on. Perhaps Oman now to keep that dialogue, but perhaps even Kuwait now through the visit. Kuwait has vested interest in making sure, ensuring that the relationship with Iran is improved. The Islamic conference is a good venue as well. And I think there are lots of other arrangements that we can think of that other countries in the world have done. Conflict in the Gulf, conflict in this region is not different from any other conflicts in the world. We've seen Europe devastated itself for hundreds of years. We've seen many people killed, but then they managed to organize themselves through different organization, whether it's the European Union, the Helsinki process, other security arrangements like that. So sometimes it needs the outside world to help. And I think the arms deal is going to help because that takes away the fear that Iran is going to develop this nuclear arsenal and is going to just spread its hegemony over the region, which is, of course, resented in the Arab world. So if you have that out of the way and Iran agrees to this armed control deal, then I think there are other issues that can be brought into the table, and there are a lot of other actors, whether regional organizations or even individuals, the perception, as I said, of the leaders themselves that can change. This is a region where, you know, the king can decide to go and visit Tehran on one day without much preparation. We've seen this even in Egypt, where Sadat just, you know, decided that he wants to go and give a talk at the Knesset. You know, one day they were fighting, and then the next day there was peace. So I think, you know, this is a region where personal perceptions of leaders plays a very, very important part. And leaders have no constituencies to control them. They don't have democratic constituencies to tell them, you know, you can't do this or can't do that. So, of course, they have a free hand to do so. And I think that can be a plus in the sense that they can find a way to deal with it.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn the floor over in a minute, but in a few minutes. But before that, Professor Malki, I want to ask you specifically about Iraq and the new challenges, perhaps, that Iraq now poses to Iran, the region, and of course the United States. And specifically, of course, Iraq has and Iran have a long history here, not least the history of the Ba'ath Party and Iran. From the 50s till the turn of the century, till 2003. Now you have a situation where of course, it is a resurgent Al-Qaeda, but also being joined maybe by remnants of the Ba'ath Party and tribes, and many seeing this as part of a continuing struggle, maybe even a new phase, if you combine it with Syria, of the Sunni-Shia struggle in the region. How does one, and discussing issues and mechanisms with which to handle this kind of crisis, how does one do that in this current context?
It's very interesting that you mentioned from 1958 until 2003, Iraq was the first threat in Iran's military doctrine, and every year they design many maneuvers and games for this case. After 2003, Iran and Iraq, they reached together very soon, and now there are many cooperations, border, bilateral, trilateral. There are energy cooperation between Iran and Iraq. A gas pipeline from Iran to Iraq, it is going to be built these years, and also from Iraq to Iran, the pipeline for products. It is not only with the southern part of Iraq, as you mentioned, Shiite, and it is with central government now, and in Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, autonomous Iqlim Kurdistan, many activities between Iran and Kurdistan also is going down. I think the first issue between Iran and Iraq is the security in Persian Gulf, which is very important. I want to propose maybe a dialogue between GCC and two other countries in this region, Iran and Iraq. Iran and Iraq, they have talked about Persian Gulf, and they shared their views, and they reached to some commonalities in this region. Historically, the case of the British soldiers, Portuguese in this region, it was not so successful for the countries. And then American forces now, the strategy or policy of pivot in Washington, D.C., it's going to change the presence of American soldiers in this region. Therefore, I think there is no need to any leader or any convener. It needs only, as my friend Abdullah said, it needs only the correct perception for security arrangement in this region, in Persian Gulf. And one dimension which is very important is energy dimension of these activities. Saudi, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, they are about 60% of proven oil reserves in this region and 25% proven gas reserves. It shows that it is a very important region. Therefore, if they cannot cooperate together, I don't know how it would be in future regarding the shale oil and shale gas and other improvement to renewables and their technologies. I think now the leaders of these countries, they reach to this point that they must work together because of the future of this region. And the last point, I think Iranian activities in Iraq, it is not only for Shiite. As I told you, we have very good relations with Kurdistani part of Iraq, with government of Iraq, and we have common threats also with Iraq and in a bigger framework with United States even. The case of Al-Qaeda, which you mentioned, the first attack of Al-Qaeda was against Iran, not from against United States and other countries in 1996. One Iranian province, Iranian city in the eastern province of Iran. And Daesh, Dawlat Islami Iraq and Sham, which is, I think, the another threat which Iran, Iraq, United States, and other Persian Gulf states, they share this danger. Really, they are going to change the Sykes-Picot agreements in this region, the case of borders and other issues. It is, I think, the main danger which we must work together to remove it.
Thank you. One more question for you. I noticed we have the Palestinian ambassador here. We also have some distinguished friends and guests who have come for the forum, also from the Palestinian side. And this, of course, the Israeli-Palestinian issue and the Arab Palestinian-Israeli issue is something which Iran has also been seen as a player. Now, let's assume maybe we don't get to rapprochement, maybe we get to an arms control agreement in detente. Are we likely to see any changes there in terms of Iran's support for certain Palestinian groups and its stance on the peace process more generally and on the two-state solution?
Really, from 1948, Iran had supported Palestinians until now. I want to say even before revolution, Iranian revolution, it was part of Iranian behaviors. If you remember, Ayatollah Khomeini, for example, permitted his followers to give money to Fatah and PLO, the money which is tax, religious tax in Shiite homes. He permitted, and that was the first in Islamic world which one religious leader did. After revolution also it was continued until now. Really, Iran feels that all of Palestinians, they must support, Iran must support all of them. And for Arab-Israeli issues, I want only to say that Iranian leader proposed a referendum in all of territories which was Palestine in the past. The one proposal from Iranian leader, I think it is good way to do that for future of this.
Thank you. Suzanne, you're free to comment on the peace process side, but I also want to ask you with regards to sanctions. I know this is a question you are often asked, is in the likelihood of a deal, are we going to see the return of international business to Iran?
I'll speak just quickly to the peace process issue, which is that the tragic collapse of the recent set of talks and hope that existed until fairly recently that there might be some new progress actually helps to facilitate some of the regional diplomacy, because it eliminates one area where Iran's activities tend to ramp up when there does appear to be some forward momentum on the peace process. So it is, I think, a very tragic development for the cause of peace, for the cause of the Palestinian people, and for the security of the Israeli state. But it paradoxically probably is a facilitating condition for regional diplomacy between Iran and its Arab neighbors. On the issue of sanctions, we've already seen a rush of businesses back to Iran. They're back in Iran, they're filling up the hotel rooms, but they're not taking out their checkbooks and their credit cards, in part, of course, because the sanctions make it impossible to use credit cards in Iran or to transfer any kinds of funds to Iran. And what we've seen over the course of the interim deal is that even the sort of modest sanctions relief that was provided as part of the bargain, whereby Iran put a stop to some of its nuclear activities, or at least put them on hold for a period of time, and received some relief from particular sanctions measures, it has not yet produced significant new investment in Iran. That was, of course, the intention of Washington and its partners in that process. To begin to show Iran what the possibilities are in a situation in which this crisis is put behind us, that there is a tremendous economic opportunity for Iran. It is, of course, much needed. The sanctions have had a devastating impact on the Iranian economy. Iran is still a very wealthy country. It has an incredible economic base, and it is poised, I think, to take off at some future point at which sanctions are a distant memory. But that will be somewhere well into the future. If and when we get a comprehensive deal, it's quite clear that any sanctions relief at that point will be staged. It will be tied to specific milestones on the Iranian side, commitments that Iran will have to fulfill. And I think it will be limited in the respect that it will not include a wholesale removal of American sanctions on Iran, because so many of those sanctions have been put in place as a result of policies other than the nuclear issue, whether it's terrorism, whether it's human rights abuses, or other issues. And so I think that we may find ourselves, if we get a deal this year, looking in another year or two at a period that looks a little bit like the late 1990s, where European businesses were returning to Iran in force, where Asian and Middle Eastern firms were competing quite aggressively for opportunities in Iran, but where the U.S.-Iranian economic relationship remains relatively anemic.
Thank you. My final question to you, Abdullah, before I turn over the floor here, turn to the floor, and that is, talk a little bit about the energy and other potential activities that could happen in the region with Iran. I notice that Oman and Iraq have signed energy deals. Dubai, of course, has traditionally been and still very much is a place for business, Iranian business activity. Are we starting to see some of that right now, or what do you see the potential? And then, sorry for just throwing in a second question, but the relationship between Iran and Egypt. It's, to me, it seems a little bit of an enigma, at least. And now with President Sisi firmly in power, what is the potential there? After the short era of Morsi, where there seemed to be some coming together.
Thank you, Salman. Professor Malki mentioned something about the fact that there could be some more energy cooperation because of the fear of the revolution of shale gas and shale oil. I would go more than that and say, yes, that is a challenge for the Gulf states, generally, including, of course, the Gulf states on both sides of the Gulf and oil-producing countries. But that there is a much more important issue than that, and that is the fact that given the consumption trend in the Gulf, in the region, of their oil and gas, this region could become energy deficient if they continue the way they were. And we can see that there are countries that are already experiencing some problems because of lack of certain kind of energy. Oman, of course, has an issue with gas, and of course, we'll come back to that. But also Kuwait. Kuwait started to import energy, especially liquefied LNG, liquefied natural gas, from Russia. And that is extremely expensive. Other Gulf states have also started to, the United Arab Emirates, for example, have a lot of need for gas. And of course, there are two countries in the region that have, they're rich in gas, that's Iran and Qatar. And I was always thinking, if there was going to be that kind of functional cooperation that glued and supported the integration process in Europe, which was the coal and steel, and because of that, it had a spill-on effect on other sectors. What is that sector in the Gulf, in the region, that is going to help further integration? And I found it difficult because all the Gulf states were exporting one product and importing everything. But things have changed. We are now in 2014. And the energy scene has, geopolitics has changed. There is a need for further gas and energy cooperation, where Iranian gas could be exported to Saudi Arabia, to Kuwait, to Oman, to the rest of the Gulf states, as well as Qatari gas, to support the development of the region. And that could be the functional sector that can have a spillover to other sectors, where you can see success in one sector, where people start to work together, you can see it happening, other sectors start to emulate that success. And this is precisely how it happened in Europe, where the coal and steel community over time started to develop and integrate more and cooperate more, and now we have something like a much regional, wider regional cooperation. So I think there is a great deal of interest, and there is a great deal for opportunities that people start to think beyond antagonism and beyond confrontation, that we all live in one region, and every country needs to develop. The youth are looking for opportunities. What are we creating for them? Not much, unless the countries cooperate. There are challenges, and we can only face challenges together. And if we can have some kind of deeper regional integration, whether that brings in Iran into the GCC, which I see is doubtful, but there are other ways of doing it, and there are other mechanisms that brings Iran, Iraq, and other countries in the region with the GCC to form some kind of a much wider regional and prosperous and stable area. Just to answer your other question very briefly, I can see at the moment Egyptian foreign policy is very much controlled by certain countries in the region. And you can see that the message was sent to the Egyptians, please invite the Iranian president because we want to talk to him. But of course he didn't turn up. And I think it is it is going to take time because in Egypt they do not see, in Iran they do not see that the Sisi is someone who came through an elected government. They don't see that that he's overthrown a legitimate government in Iran, and at least this is their perception. And at the moment, they're playing hard to get with Egypt. And I think any Egyptian Iranian rapprochement will have to go through through Riyadh and maybe Abu Dhabi.
Only I want to add one sentence for Abdullah. Mr. Amir Abdullahian, who is a deputy foreign minister of Iran, attended to the ceremony of Mr. Sisi. He did a conversation with him about 5 minutes when they did shake hands. I think the Egypt, future of Egypt, it is related to many parameters and many factors for Iran foreign policy. One of them is the Egyptian government. Egypt is a very, very important country. Civilization, geopolitics, its geopolitics, Suez Canal, the case of the Arab-Israeli conflict, all of these issues. I think Iranians, they are analyzing the situation and they will have relations between Egypt and Iran.
Thank you. I'll now turn to the floor. I know there are at least 15 to 20 people in this audience who could probably ask better questions than I have. So and definitely, let's see if we can take as many questions as possible. And if you could, I could just ask you, please to just state your name and any affiliation. That would be great. That would be very helpful. I'll start with the gentleman right next to the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Marwan Qabalan. And I want to talk about two main points. The first one is that there is this feeling in the region that the Fertile Crescent, i.e. Iraq and Syria, have fallen victim to the animosity between the United States and Iran. The United States invaded Iraq in 2003. The Iranians, they initially assisted the Americans in order to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but they later on turned against them in order to turn Iraq into another Vietnam for the Americans. Now the Americans are doing exactly the same for the Iranians in Syria. And we believe that this will be going on until the Americans and the Iranians agree on the nuclear issue, which in my which leads me to the second point, that the nuclear issue shouldn't be actually a matter of concern for the Arabs or the GCC countries, except is as much as it addresses Iran regional influence and its policies. I think the Iranian nuclear program shouldn't be a matter of concern for the Arabs, because it's not. It's a matter of concern for the Israelis, and that is why President Obama is actually trying to address the concern of the Israelis, but using the blood of the Arabs in order to get the concessions from the Iranians in order to solve this this issue. Nuclear weapons, in my opinion, are not made to be used. They are used as a deterrence, as a tool to blackmail the other, but it's not going to be used. What should concern the GCC more is Iran conventional weapons, Iran expansionist policies, and Iran hegemonic inclinations. Finally, I just wanted Mr. Maliki, this is my final point, I just wanted Mr. Maliki actually to speak more as an academic, because what we have been hearing is Iran official policy line. It's more like, I mean, Mr. Zarif speaking rather than an academic from a university. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I liked your questions better. The lady at the back. Yes, please. Reem.
My question is to Mr. Maliki. Mr. Maliki, there has been some claims that Iran is using sectarianism in their foreign policy. Thus, There has been some claims that Iran is escalating sectarianism in both Syria and Iraq for now. So I wonder, what do you think about this? What do you think the Iranians are doing with these two governments in both Iran, Iraq and Syria? Thank you.
My question is for Ms. Maloney. You said you consider Iran a combatant in Syria. Recently, there was news that the United States is training fighters here in Qatar to go back and fight in Syria. Do you consider the United States also a combatant in Syria?
Bruce Riddell from Brookings. My question is to both to Suzanne and to Dr. Maliki. With the fall of Mosul and the apparent advance of ISIS forces, do the United States and Iran now have an urgent need to collaborate to rescue their client state in Baghdad? And more specifically to Dr. Maliki, you mentioned that Iran was the target of the first al-Qaeda attack. Could you give us a little more detail on that?
Okay, why don't we stop there? We'll have surely another round or so. Dr. Maliki.
Yes. Regarding my similarity of my views with Dr. Zarif, yes, it is similar because Zarif and me, we are friends and we have worked together in foreign policy of Iran many years, and now he's the minister and I am academic. Maybe few years later, it would be vice versa. Anyhow, second, case of sectarianism and Iranian activities, I want to say first, Iran is a pluralistic country. There are many players in Iran. For example, many Iranians, they love to go to holy shrines in Syria and Iraq. It is not to Iranian government to tell them to invest there or not, but there are huge investment in Karbala, Najaf, Damascus, and other cities. Iranians, they love Ahlul Bayt, and they want to do that. And in other part of this region, the Arabs from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other countries, they love to go to Mashhad, a holy shrine in Iran, and they have invested in Mashhad and northern part of Iran. Therefore, I think the only responsibility of Iran and other states and governments is to design policies for such trades and interactions. But if you look at the region, who sent troops to other countries? Was it Iran in the Persian Gulf or other countries? Who sent the combatants in other countries? Really, Iran supported Syrian regime from, as I told you, from 1958, which Baath's party, Baath Party raised to power in Iraq. This is the case of geopolitics. It is not hidden. But the case of sectarianism means we supported some peoples in Syria against other peoples. No, it is not true. Iran supports government of Syria. In Iraq also, as I told you, Kurds, they are Sunnis. Iran has good relations with Kurds, with the government of Iraq, which has a network of Sunnis and Shiites. It is not so vital for Iran who is Sunni, who is Shiite, who is Muslim, who is not Muslim. Look at Iran's relations with Armenia. It is very good relations. Armenians, they are Christians. Look at Iran's relations with Afghans. Most of them, they are Sunnis, with other countries also. I want to say nationalist interest in Iran is more than other issues, But I believe if Iran had good relations with Islamic countries, it is also part of national interest of Iran. And Boris asked about the first attack of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda did in 1996 an explosion in Mashhad Holy Shrine, and it was about, I think, 30 people had been killed. It was the first, and then they announced the attack against Shiites, which they told that they are out of Islam and something like that.
Suzanne, a couple of questions your way, but also, is this all about Israel when it comes to the nuclear deal as well?
Well, and I'll answer that somewhat extemporaneously because I couldn't catch all of the phrasing of the question. Clearly, there's a close relationship between the United States and Israel on a range of regional concerns, and Iran often ranks very high amongst those. But I think we've also seen in a very public fashion over the course of the past year in particular that there are also very deep differences between President Obama, the rest of the American security establishment, and the current Israeli government on issues of Iran as well as other issues. And so, like all allies, we coordinate, we are very committed to supporting the defense and the preservation of Israeli survival, but we are not in lockstep, and we're certainly not dictated to by the Israeli government. There can be no better evidence of that than the sort of policies this Obama administration has implemented, both with respect to Iran and obviously with respect to the peace process over the course of the past year. On the issue of sectarianism, which I recognize was not addressed to me, but I'll just say a quick word about, I think it's quite clear that Iran would prefer a world without sectarianism. Ayatollah Khomeini couched his appeal to the Islamic world very broadly to the Ummah. But it's also quite clear that Iran's message, Iran's efforts to provide support and find proxies across the Islamic world have always found greater resonance among Shia communities, both here in the Gulf and, of course, in Lebanon. And that is powerful influence, and it's influence that I think it's unlikely the Iranian government will give up readily. That said, I think that they recognize and have recognized for quite some time the threat of inflamed sectarianism in Syria. Before Syria became a counterterrorism issue for Washington, which it clearly is today, you would hear in the Iranian press and from Iranian officials quite a lot of talk about the concerns about jihadist and Salafist influence among the opposition. And so this is a long-standing and I think quite legitimate concern, and we've seen it play out in direct fashion over the course of the past few days. I don't expect direct cooperation between Washington and Tehran on preserving the integrity, the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the state of Iraq. I can only hope, however, that both governments, which have imperfect influence over the government of Prime Minister Maliki, find a way to ensure that this government does not in fact collapse, that Iraq's borders are not in fact erased as a result of the rise of these groups, and that their efforts to do so are in some way harmonious, if not entirely coordinated. And just finally, on the issue of the United States, whether the United States is a combatant in Syria, I think it's quite clear that we are not today, although many in Washington and elsewhere would wish that we were. And I think that even at a point in which we may be more heavily involved in training and equipping the Syrian opposition, we are unlikely to see a scene, as we have seen on several occasions in Tehran in recent years, whereby senior military officials attend the funeral of military fighters who were killed in Syria. That has happened in Iraq, in Iran, in the case apparently defending the shrines. Informally, but there's clearly a very direct conduit of support, of advisory role with the Bashar Assad government, and as well in terms of direct contributions to the Syrian army. And so I think there's really no parallel between the Iranian role in Syria and the American role in Syria today.
Abdullah, just very quickly, if you speak to this issue of sectarianism and Iran being accused of actually escalating sectarianism from your perspective.
Well, if I may also, I want to come up on the issue about Israel. I think Israel is going to be against any state in the region developing a nuclear capability. But I think it will be wrong to think that the Iranian nuclear capability is because of Israel, or it could threaten Israel in the future. I think where we should see and look at where why Iran is trying to develop this capacity or this capability is because of their need to protect themselves. Iran, the Velayat Faqih in Iran, is the only of its one of its kind in the world. They've developed it through the Shia thinking, and they want to keep it. And you know the call for the downfall of the that regime has got them to think seriously about protecting it. But also, Iran is surrounded by other nuclear powers, and they see that they need to develop their own thinking. So I think we should look to the reasons, the real reasons why Iran is developing this. To think that Iran could attack Israel or even contemplate doing that, it's madness, because you know if they do so, Israel is a very mature nuclear power that can take the first strike and retaliate. Well, Iran could not do that. You know what is known as mad in security paradigm. It's going to be madness to think that Iran could attack at any point Israel. So I think there are other reasons, and some of them may be things that I have mentioned, but there may be other reasons as well, maybe regional hegemony that comes with it and the weight that nuclear power can bring in. I can see and I can hear here in this hall that people are accusing each other of starting, who started the sectarian war and sectarian conflict. And we can sit until, for a long time listening to these accusations. In my opinion, all have started it. Iran has started it, but also other Gulf states and other people in the Gulf states have started it. Each one is in retaliation for the other. The thing is, you start one, and you get a retaliation, and the others start to do the same, and it start to get bigger and out of control and grow out of control. Remember Al-Qaeda. Remember how it was started. Remember what is done. What we are seeing now is even organizations that are worse than Al-Qaeda in terms of their brutality. They are not only threatening the states, but they are threatening innocent people. And both sides, and I mean it, from both sides, the Iranians and their allies in the region, but also the Arabs and the Gulf Arabs are supporting this, whether they are official governments or non-official governments. They are doing this. And what they are doing is they're creating monsters in the region that is going to come to haunt them as Al-Qaeda did in the past.
Thank you. I'll take first Louis at the back here.
Thank you. Louis Khatib, Brookings Doha Center. Mr. Maliki, over the past 5-6 years, huge debate dominated this discussion in Parliament, in Iraq in Parliament, and also in public about the fact that Iraq is deprived access to international waters. And this is because of the issue of the 1975 treaty, Algeria treaty, pre the revolution, and then followed by the issue of the post-1991 post 1990, the invasion of Kuwait and the UN Security Council resolutions that granted more lands and more water access to Kuwait. This left Iraq with very limited access to international waters. And neither Kuwait nor Iran are very much desperate for the few kilometers that Iraq should have or historically had until even many years after the fall of the monarchy. The question is, do you think Iran will ease such access to Iraqis? Unfortunately, we don't have a Kuwaiti panelist to talk on this, but like at least from the Iranian side, do you think a country like yours that enjoys over 2,000 kilometers of waterfront will ease a few excess of kilometers to give back to Iraq, especially that the country enjoyed such access for many years?
Thank you. I'll take one more in the back and then I'm going to come here. Is there one more person in the back? Please.
My question is to Mr. Maliki. Daesh has controlled the north of Iraq. Do you think that they declare a state of their own? What does the Iranian government think of that?
It is the issue of legal studies, which maybe you are expert on that case. And I have worked on this treaty of governmental borders, treaty of friendship and governmental borders between Iran and Republic of Iraq was signed in 1975 after meeting of Shah and Saddam Hussein in Algiers during the OPEC summit. It was signed in Saadabad Palace in Tehran. This treaty has three major issues, which is very important. First is the case of, again, demarcation of borders between Iran and Iraq, which some of them has been changed during the time because of the many natural disasters and some other issues. Second, it was the prohibition of supporting the opposition of each country in another country. For example, the Kurds, which they have had good relations with Iran, Barzani, Mullah Mustafa Barzani and others, and in another side, Ayatollah Khomeini and others in Najaf and Karbala. And the third world was the Talwik or deepest line of Shatul Arab or Arvand route as Iran-Iraq border. Before that, the border between Iran and Ottoman Empire and then Iraq state was the east coast of Shatul Arab. Therefore, 1975 changed east coast of Shatul Arab to the Talwik line, tentatively median line, something like that. Therefore, I don't think the access of Iraqi state to Persian Gulf has been limited because of 1975. As you know, the terminals of Al-Bakr and Al-Umayyah and others, they are in the front of Faf in the northern part of Persian Gulf. But in the other side, in Khur Abdullah, as you mentioned, after 1990, there are two decisions by United Nations about the demarcation of water borders between Iraq and Kuwait, which it is related to Iraq and Kuwait to decide about it. But the last point is that Iran is ready to do many facilities for Iraq, as Iran does. Now trucks and tankers, they are going from Kurdistan and from Zubair and others to Iran and from Iran to Dubai and others by ships, tankers. Therefore, there are many other activities the two countries they are doing. And Daesh Iran is opposing any geopolitical or any changes in the map of the this region, the borders and other issues, and really Iran is very concerned about these activities. And despite of the fact that one gentleman said that maybe Iran and United States don't talk about such threats about the territorial integrity of Iraq, I think they will do in the future, as they did in the past. Iranian ambassador in Iraq, Mr. Qomi, and I think Ryan Kruger, something, ambassador of United States, they did twice in Baghdad.
Thank you. Sorry, we didn't all hear the question, so I'm glad you explained on the Daesh question. I'm going to take three more questions. I know there's a lot of people who want. The gentleman there, yep, and then behind you.
My name is Akram Hussain from the Center of Strategic Studies. I have two questions. The first question to Mr. Maliki. Is it possible that there will be a differences in the position between Bashar Assad regime and Iran, especially after it is clear that there is an increase in the role of Iran in the Syrian issue, as was seen in different and that Iran wants to lead the talks on behalf of Syria and decide the fate of Syria in maybe bilateral negotiations with some of international bodies or regional bodies. And the regime in Syria also wishes to say to its people that it has overcome the armed opposition by itself and not by the help of other countries or by Iranian help. And we have noticed that there was some irritation in the Syrian government of the increase of the offices, Iranian offices inside Syria, and that are taking part in negotiations about disarmament of some groups in Homs and elsewhere.
Can I please try and get a couple more questions in? Yes?
I have much.
Thank you very much. And if I could ask you to have that discussion. The gentleman there and then the gentleman in the front. Thank you.
Thank you. Zuhair Hamdi, research.
Zuhair Hamdi, Bahath Fi.
Pact of an agreement, not necessarily a rapprochement, but an agreement on the nuclear issue on the energy markets. Because an agreement, which will most likely happen, and I share the optimism of the speakers of the panel in that regard, will allow for Iran to come back to its previous production capacities and maybe even increase its production capacities, because the Iranian production capacities have been somehow hindered by not only the latest oil embargo, but all the economic sanctions since the Iranian revolution, and the Iranian oil industry didn't have the capacity to import equipments and technology and to manage properly its energy reserves. So, what is going to be the impact on the energy markets, and how? How OPEC especially is going to deal with that, knowing that Saudi Arabia is going to be the biggest loser when Iran will come back to its previous oil capacities. This is on the international oil markets. Internally, domestically, lifting the sanctions on Iran will, I think, have also implications on the domestic policy of Iran. We know that the sanctions have allowed for maintaining a kind of relative unity within Iran. So what will be the implications on the domestic policy in Iran after the lifting of the sanctions in the mid to the long term? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the gentleman just at the front here.
Zahir Ahraki, Safir Suri.
A Syrian ambassador in Syria, in Doha. Iran used to attack United States and the West as a whole, saying that they use double standards about the nuclear issue. Now Iran is falling in the same trap in helping the uprising in Bahrain, at least in the media, while they attack the revolution in Syria by all means, even by men and weapons, media, and there are so many evidence to that. Isn't this a contradiction? Or is it just a sectarian project that Iran wants to apply in the region after applying it to Iraq, and which years ago Malik Abdullah II in Jordan had warned us off? This is also in the same contradiction. Iran is the same contradiction when it says that the chemical weapons are rejected, religiously speaking, but as accepts using it in Syria, and falls into the same contradiction when Iran changes its government peacefully while as supports a dictator in Syria.
Ambassador, if we could just go down the line and address the questions that have been directed to you, particularly you, Professor Malki.
Regarding the nuclear deal and its impact on energy market, as you mentioned, has impact. But there are a few issues which I raise. First, Iran capacity would be raised in the future. Now it's about, for example, 3 million barrels per day. As Minister Zangen said, they are going to do it to 5 million barrels per day. Maybe there are the 6-5 year plan in Iran, which is writing now, the expert, they are writing it, 5. But at the same time, this is a major debate in Iran. Is it really in favor of Iran to return to policies which Iran had in the past, before the revolution, which Iran had 6.5 million barrels per day production? Between Saudi Arabia and Iran on that time and Doha, the price of oil on that time in 1976 dropped after that conference because of the huge excess capacity of Saudi Arabia, which therefore Iran. I think Iran doesn't need 6.5 million barrels per day. Iran has two problems. One problem is the case of the technology which Iran is going to have access to. Modern technology. Second, Iran conservation policy is more important than production policy. We waste about 1 million barrels per day of crude oil products in Iran totally because of the lack of efficiency, productivity, and issues like that. Therefore, Iran's policy has shifted to those issues. But despite all of these issues, the demand in the world is rising sharply because of China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, and other countries, Russia. Therefore, I think still demand is important, and even after nuclear deal and Iran's production, Iran export access to adds to the market, I think the supply doesn't have a matter and demand is more important. As Iraq also now is all of these issues, I think, in the future, this shows that the countries in the region, they must work together because of the oil price, which is the most important thing for these countries. Regarding sectarianism, I think the only answer would be who sent troops to Bahrain. If Iran is a country which is meddling in Bahrain, Bahrainis, they have relations with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with Qatar, and others, because this is the Islamic world. All of them, they are the same. They have same religion and same destiny in the future.
And on Bashar?
To have different policies in future. We did have similarity with Syria in the past, and also some difference views, divergence. It is natural. But on chemical weapons, Iran is victim of chemical weapons because of the Saddam Hussein attack to Iranian troops, and also to the people of Iraq. Many of these attacks on that time were supported and were financed by other Persian Gulf states.
On the question of energy policy, I think this is actually one of the areas that will drive some conversation between Riyadh and Tehran. It's actually an area where, despite the fact that the Saudis have successfully used the oil weapon against Iran in several cases, but very successfully, repeatedly, since the pre-revolutionary period, during the war, after the war, and now, of course, during this most recent sanctions period, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been able to achieve a reasonably constructive cooperation at different points in time within OPEC. And one of the individuals who's most responsible for that from the Iranian side is Bijan Zanganeh, and I think that was a deliberate signal with his return to the President Rouhani. He is at least as important to Iran's regional diplomacy as Foreign Minister Zarif, and he will be critical to managing the process of Iran's return to full production capability. I would add a note of caution about the likelihood of ever seeing the 6.5 million barrels a day again. Iranian oil ministers have been projecting targets consistently since the end of the war with Iraq and have never achieved them. And as Dr. Maliki said, there is, I think, some energy around the idea in Iran that what has happened over the course of the past few years should be used as a bridge to an economy that is at least somewhat post-oil, less dependent on oil revenues. And it remains to be seen if that will actually be achieved. One very quick point on Syria, and I recognize the question wasn't addressed to me, so I apologize for I think it's important to note that despite the fact that the copious support for Bashar, the intense involvement of the Iranian government in the conflict in Syria, I think it's also quite clear that Tehran and particularly important elements of the Iranian power structure have been hedging on Syria from the start. I don't know that Bashar is well loved by even the members of the Iranian security establishment. I think what we've seen with the Iranian efforts to broker ceasefires in various parts of the country is a determination by Tehran to ensure that it preserves its access and influence even at a time in which Bashar may no longer be part of the picture. I do think that it's almost inconceivable that we would see Tehran willing to give up the basic structure of the regime, but the individual himself
the energy issue. I think that is one of the items on the agenda that can bring the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia and Iran, to work together. There are, of course, many issues that they bring them together. One of them is the sectarian issue and so on, which we talked about. But the energy issue is one of the most important ones. Because, not unless Mr. Maliki had just saying that there's more oil coming in. Iran wants more share, lifting up the sanctions, or partly lifting up the sanctions. They need to deliver to their people, and they need foreign income. Iraq is also doing the same thing. They need more to export more oil. Libya is also coming on the stream, but also there are the challenge, the main challenge coming from the shale gas and shale oil, not only in the United States, but perhaps even in Africa and other China and other places. So I think the oil price is going to be challenged. And if the oil price is challenged, you can read that the security of many of these countries are also going to be challenged. No longer can many of the Gulf states go back to the $30 and $40 dollars per barrel. Basically, that is totally unacceptable. They cannot even meet their break-even point because of economic policies that they have pursued for a very long time. Some of them are inefficient economic policies. Now the break-even price is about 80 plus even 90. Below that, you're talking about these countries having some huge budget deficits that can affect their development. So they are bound by this to cooperate together. And of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia being the two major countries in the region that produce that kind of oil, and they need to cooperate together. Of course, through OPEC. I will stop there because the other questions have been
answered. Thank you. I'm sure we can continue for a while, but we started a little bit late, but we must finish now. Before I thank the guests, I guess my sort of mini conclusions at this point is there is some optimism for a deal, maybe not in, probably not in the time frame that has been set for now. Professor Malki, you put it at 50-50, but long-term you expressed some optimism there. But as our discussion showed, and as certainly we heard from the audience, there are a number of other issues, particularly Syria and Iraq, and the general existential debate that comes up when it comes to the issue of sectarianism and the promotion of sectarianism or otherwise, which will continue to present real challenges in terms of even if there is a détente or further a rapprochement in the region, and this will require a lot of work and a lot of dialogue, communication, and cooperation. The question is how can that happen, and will it happen moving forward? So, I guess the best I can summarize is that in this current phase, there is opportunity, but we must also look out for crisis and how to avert that at this point in time. Let me next just please thank our three esteemed guests for coming, Professor Malki, Suzanne Maloney, Dr. Abdullah Babood. If we could just give them a round of applause. Thank you also, and there are some refreshments outside. Please do join us. Thank you.